thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a bi-weekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 7. For the 30th of May, 2007, History Appliances. Welcome once again to Digital Campus. We are really fortunate today because in addition to our regulars, we have a visitor from Canada. We're here with Bill Turkle. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Bill blogs, it's really just a terrific blog, one of the best history blogs out there. At digitalhistoryhacks.blogspot.com. And if you haven't subscribed already, it's a great blog covering all of Bill's really original thoughts in digital history, as well as more general thoughts about technology and the humanities. And in addition to Bill, we also have with us our regulars, Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hey, Dan. How are you?
Good. You had a good long weekend?
Yeah, it was great.
Great. And you can find Mills, of course, at edwired.org. And also here, our other regular is Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
Good to see you again. Hope you had a good weekend, too.
Yeah, pretty good.
A hot Memorial weekend down here. Tom, of course, is at foundhistory.org. And I'm Dan Cohen. Of course, you can find me at dancohen.org. Well, we have lots of news stories from the past couple of weeks that we'd like to go over. Those of you who are new to the podcast should know that we like to begin with about 15 or 20 minutes going over new stories on technology and their impact on academia, libraries, and museums. And then we'll be talking to Bill in greater depth about some projects and things that he's doing in the realm of what he calls history appliances. So we're all really looking forward to that after the news roundup. Well, there's lots of stories, and I suppose the one that really caught our eye the most and that's been getting a lot of buzz is a story on Facebook, which we've talked about on several of the Digital Campus podcasts. And the news there was that Facebook opened itself for development or third-party developers. And Mills, do you want to talk a little bit about what you think this means? And maybe we should discuss a little bit the technology that's going on as well.
Well, one of the things that is going to be possible with this is that individuals are going to be able to start creating tools or widgets that can be used in Facebook for a whole variety of things. So, for instance, if a librarian at a university could develop a widget to let students know from their Facebook page which books they had out or which books were overdue or would be coming overdue shortly, those kinds of things. Individual students will be able to create widgets to surf through friends lists of other people, maybe. I mean, there are a whole variety of things that they'll be able to come up with.
It seems that the initial applications had to do with music recommendations, things like that. But I guess it'd be possible for an individual college or university or library or museum to actually set up some kind of internal application or social application within the Facebook platform. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg, is that right? The head of Facebook called it a social operating system, which I suppose is ambitious. But I guess we have yet to see. Tom, what do you think some applications are that could be written?
Well, I do know that one of our new staff members here at CH&M, a guy named Dave Lester, who's a real talented programmer and a good thinker on digital history, has used the Facebook API in the past to do some online survey work. He's been studying the history of the Oregon Trail game from the 1980s, and he has used the Facebook API to embed a survey to attract responses, kind of virtual oral histories from players of Oregon Trail, from enthusiast groups on Facebook. And so, I mean, that's one application of how kind of an open architecture for these social networking sites could be used. This, I think, takes it one step further and allows you to build applications on the Facebook platform. One of the things, though, that I think is a little will be interesting to watch as this moves further is just how open Facebook wants to be with all of this. I know MySpace has allowed for widget development for a while now, and they've actually cracked down on it.
Right,
they're keeping people from writing widgets because people have been doing some things that MySpace doesn't like.
Right, I guess the peril is that it becomes more like a MySpace, which is far more chaotic. The design degrades. There's possibilities for injecting all kinds of nasty stuff into the Facebook platform. I guess on this show a couple of episodes ago, we were sort of promoting Facebook as at least it's well designed as opposed to MySpace, and it had certain advantages over MySpace in terms of being better for certainly for colleges and universities, which is its original market. The question now is whether by opening itself up in this way, it becomes a little bit more of a mishmash, and I think professors will begin to shy away from it because of that.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that I think it's a big risk because, on the one hand, it'll be very interesting to see what kinds of things the users develop as opposed to the developers develop. And then at the same time, I think it's going to be interesting to see whether this is the thing which keeps Facebook going and growing, or is it the kind of thing that then drives the student users off to some other new and cool platform?
Right. Yeah, that'll be interesting to see. I think we keep speculating on this podcast about abandoning Facebook and what the next new trend will be. So I guess we'll keep track of that this summer. On another major site, of course, Google, which we also talk quite a bit about on the podcast, I think made a very slight, at least subtle, change, but I think one that's very substantial for academia, which is what they're calling universal search. And what they're now doing is in the single box search that they're known for and that they dominate the market for, they're now adding in all the other media types and file types into one gigantic search. So, for instance, if you go to your browser right now, go to google.com and type in quotation marks, "I have a dream," you'll get, for instance, in the first few hits, the Wikipedia entry for Martin Luther King Jr., of course, but you'll also now get, as the fourth hit, a Google video. I don't believe it's YouTube. I think it's on Google Video of the actual speech. And I think this really is going to sort of change the way that, we've talked a lot about students and ourselves sort of looking at Google and finding results in that way. And now all of a sudden it's bringing in a lot of different media into that single search box that we rely on so much. And I really wonder if this is going to change the way that certainly students who are very quick to go to Google are going to find stuff and use that material for their work.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely going to change things. I even know for myself, I sort of have a hard time keeping track of exactly which search services Google is now offering. I mean, if you look at their pull-down lists of search services, I mean, there's the web, then there's images, videos, Scholar, Google Books, Google Scholar. I mean, even keeping those two separate, like, well, what's in Google Books, what's in Google Scholar? I think we who keep track of those things know the difference. But I think your average user, even your average academic user, your average researcher, doesn't necessarily know what Google has out there and which branch of Google to go to for what they're looking for. And this will just kind of spit it all out in the way that I think people expect. When people go to Google, they expect to get everything from their one search box search. And this I think, is meeting that expectation.
Another Google story that caught our eye this past couple of weeks is that they have banned, along with alcohol and tobacco, advertising for term paper services, as they are called. Although it looked to me like some of the people who tested this still found these services. Now, what this is those little text ads that Google puts up to the right of their search results should no longer show these often illegal or problematic, at least from a professor's perspective, essay writing or term paper things. But I think it was one of the search engine blogs did a bunch of testing, and they still found a lot of these services still there. They just changed the keywords under which this result would show up. Should we be concerned? Do we care about these things? I guess we've talked about plagiarism in prior podcasts.
Yeah, you know, the paper writing database services, or the essays for sale, you know, it's got to be one of the more successful applications on the internet. It's certainly not nearly as profitable as pornography, but it's got to be a pretty profitable business, just judging by the number of the services that are out there. And it's a, you know, from a business standpoint, it's an excellent application of the internet. From an educational standpoint, it's hugely problematic because, you know, so many students buy things online and then turn them in. And it's very difficult sometimes to know what they bought and what they haven't bought. I mean, my own solution is to combat this, I assign papers based on what we talked about in class yesterday rather than on some kind of general topic like the main points of Darwin's work on evolution. That there must be 800 papers available for sale on that. So I end up having to come up with fairly obscure things for my students to write about, obscure in the sense that we talked about them in class yesterday. And those papers aren't for sale. But it's also a question of whether services like Turnitin.com will eventually begin to erode the market for those papers as more and more of those papers show up in these plagiarism-catching services.
Right. I mean, isn't the bigger problem that it's the ease of the cutting and pasting from just regular old web pages, right? Rather than someone actually going out and buying a term paper. I mean, I assume that happens quite a bit, but I think most of what, at least I've encountered, is just wholesale copying from web pages, which I've just found through simple Google searches of unusual phrases in papers that students turn in.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. I think certainly in my own case, that's a much more common thing. Of course, I don't know. Maybe students of mine have been buying a lot of term papers and turning them in and getting grades from me, and I just haven't caught it. But the cutting and pasting is a lot more common. For one thing, as we all know, people want free stuff from the internet. They would rather not pay, and so I think a lot of students spend a fair amount of time searching around for something useful and free rather than something useful that costs $14.95.
Right. I always feel like we have a legal segment of the podcast when we go through our legal story. So while we're on that, Tom, do you want to tell us about this story that came out about the liberation of these Smithsonian images?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story. The Smithsonian has been running what some people are now calling a racket for a while now with a site called SmithsonianImages.com or something like that. And it's essentially just a digitized collection of very good, very interesting, very high quality images from the Smithsonian's collections that you can pay a license fee and use the way you would get something from Corbis or one of the other big image licensing services, and they're great images, and they're really useful. A nonprofit organization, and I can't. Dan, do you have the name? I can't remember the name. I think it's
I
called.
Can't remember the name.
I think it might be called Public Resource. I think it is called Public Resource. They
and they've done a lot of copyright activism.
Yeah, right? They're a copyright activist organization. They basically saw this collection and realized that the Smithsonian was charging licensing fees for things that were in the public domain. These are, for the most part, or at least they say for the most part, images, photographs that were taken by federal employees. And by definition, images taken by federal employees are in the public domain and the Smithsonian shouldn't be collecting licensing fees for those images. So what they did was they went to the website, they pulled down all 6,000 images, and they threw them up on Flickr. And you can now access them on Flickr, and we'll put the link in the show notes. We're not endorsing this. We're not saying whether they're right one way or another, but we'll put the link in show notes just for your information. You can now have a copy of any of these images for free downloaded from Flickr. But I think really they're trying to make the point that the Smithsonian, which has had of late a lot of questions being asked of their finances and the way they spend their money, the way they make their money, their mission as a publicly funded, a predominantly publicly funded, and publicly oriented institution. A lot of questions have been being asked of them with the departure of Smalls, the former secretary. And I think this public resource organization is trying to make a statement about public information and our access to it.
Hmm. Hmm. The final, I think, story on the legal front is also in a sort of sketchy legal realm was you read over the weekend in the New York Times had coverage of this digital assault on Estonia. And for those who hadn't heard about this, essentially, when Estonia tried to pull down a statue that sort of honored the fallen Soviet soldier and move it to another location, they all of a sudden were hit by what are called distributed denial of service attacks, which are essentially internet packet floods of your network that or a server that essentially just overwhelm your IT infrastructure and make it pretty much impossible to do any of your normal activities like email or banking. This went on for quite some time, I think a couple of weeks. It's finally ebbed. I was sort of interested by this and also the story that came out on the Chronicle of Higher Ed blog about sort of all the punishments that are going on at Ohio University for their supposed lax security, or not supposed, I guess they did have some amount of lax security, and they were because they were hacked 5 times in a year, their servers were hacked 5 times in a year. And my thoughts on this were, first of all, all of us are really open and to these kinds of attacks. I mean, I think a university, there's no way a university could defend themselves if they needed if they needed to. If some script kiddie or user who has a bunch of zombie machines out there wants to flood our network, there's not a whole lot we can do. There are techniques. But also, I think this question of hacking, I mean, we've actually, our server's been hacked a couple of times. And I just feel that so much hacking is going on right now. And it's such a, it's so easy to, I think, penetrate and disrupt IT infrastructures that it seems to me that Ohio University is sort of getting a bad rap. Look, at least they're telling people that they've been hacked. It seems to me that... think about how many students, say at George Mason, have Windows machines that have not been upgraded, haven't been patched, and they're sitting without a router in front of them, so without any kind of hardware firewall in front of them, directly connected to a high-speed internet connection. I guarantee you that many of these machines are compromised. And you know, even here at Mason, they're worrying about, they're constantly scanning our machines to see if you know we could be hacked. The problem is as I see it, is you don't know the really good hacks, you don't know about them, right? And so this Estonia case is just a very obvious case where essentially we're flooded with information. But I think universities are very good targets for this kind of material. And I don't really know what or this kind of hacking, because they're on high speed networks, etc. I think there's probably a lot more hacking out there that we don't know about, right?
Yeah, I think it's true. And I think one of the things that makes the Estonia story especially interesting is that it's not really clear who exactly was behind the assault on the Estonian network. The Estonian government is trying to blame the Russian government for it because a couple of the IP addresses that were used to send things, like assaults on the Estonian network, were IP addresses controlled by various people in higher levels of the Russian government. Russian government says this is complete baloney. And if it's not the Russian government, then it's a group, in the New York Times story, they refer to them as hacktivists. So hackers with a political agenda. And I think this is a really interesting aspect of the story that increasingly, I mean, 20 years ago, only a few people could really be called hackers. Today, so many people have programming skills and network skills that potential universe of hackers has really expanded. And so it's not surprising to me, I guess, that people with a political agenda and access to a high-speed network will use that skill to try to pursue their own agenda. And so it's quite possible that it's just average people with hacking skills who happen to be Russian and mad at the Estonians who conspired in a very loose way to run this assault. And so it could be a completely amorphous thing. And it's just a consequence of so many people developing programming skills.
Right. And there are off-the-rack software applications that'll do a lot of this stuff for you. I mean, you might not be able to command 100,000 zombie machines, but, I think it's relatively trivial to find the kinds of applications that will hack into a Linux server, into a Windows machine are very easy. I mean, if you look at the upgrade stats for cluster computers, so these are computers that aren't personal machines, but that are run by universities and libraries, those machines are only upgraded, you know, once a month on Patch Tuesday. Microsoft might send out some patches, or they're done by the IT department. They get a full upgrade, let's say once a summer, to put new applications on it, and they might not be the applications, not the OS, might be patched once a year. And so it just leaves these long periods of time where they're vulnerable to attack. And all of these scripts and hacks are available for weeks or months, and you just have to scan an IP range and hack into those machines. I think there's probably a big underground, you know, hundreds of millions of computers that are hacked in this way and that people just don't know about. Well, on that cheery note, we will move on to our feature story with Bill Turkle. Well, as I said at the top of the podcast, we're really fortunate to have Bill Turkle here. He's visiting from Canada, from the University of Western Ontario, where he is an assistant professor in the Department of History. And as I also mentioned, Bill has a terrific blog on digital history hacks. And he's visiting here at the Center for History and New Media. And I should mention, actually, this is our first podcast that we've actually done truly around a roundtable. We always talk about being around a virtual roundtable, but we're usually on Skype, either in our offices or from home. But this time we're actually around a single microphone. It'll be interesting to see what the sound quality looks like, but it gives us a chance to actually look at Bill and talk directly to his face. And indeed, that seems to be, I think, one of the interesting things that Bill is working on, is sort of combining the digital with physical presence and with the advantages of what you can do with what he calls history appliances. So maybe, Bill, I suppose the first thing we'd wanted to ask you is, what are these history appliances, and where can we get them, at Circuit City or Best Buy or Fry's Electronics?
Okay, well, that's a good question. First of all, I think the name History Appliances is just a terrible name, and I hope somebody comes up with something better. But the basic idea was, as computing becomes kind of more ubiquitous, as it becomes more like things like literacy or plumbing or electricity, we start to stop thinking in terms of computers, and we start thinking in terms of experiences. And I was trying to think of what kinds of things in our everyday life mediate our experiences. You know, what would we do so that having access to some kind of a historical experience would be like flipping on a light switch or turning on a tap or something like that? Hence this kind of rough idea of making something like a history appliance, something quotidian, something inexpensive, something that gives you access to historical data or historical experiences or something like that.
Hmm. And tell us a little bit about sort of what are the mechanisms involved, the hardware, the software, and the kinds of things that you would envision doing with this. Maybe a concrete example or two.
Okay, well, kind of an easy example might be something like, if you had in your house, if you had something that was like a dial that you could set to a date, to a year, maybe you could sort of set the dial to something like 1973, and then all of your media, which would be presumably interactive and becoming up from a database, would then reflect that setting. So you might, if you had picture frames on the wall, they might set to images from 1973. If your stereo might start playing tracks from that year, you could imagine turning on the TV and seeing programs or movies from that year, that kind of thing. So that's a kind of a, since it's all based on media, it's at least easy to imagine how something like that might work. But I think it could go quite a ways beyond that.
Mm-hmm. It also seems like there is some interactivity with the objects as well. I have on my XM radio, I have the 70s station is one of my preset. Takes me back to my great childhood, along with Tom and great WAAF in Worcester, Massachusetts, which we both listened to,
yes,
and banged our heads to what now seems to be actually pretty good music, looking back on it. Beyond the golden oldies syndrome and the sentimentality, it seems like you're really trying to get at reproducing some kind of interactivity and historical experience in a way, and feedback mechanisms, these kinds of things. So a student, for instance, could not only experience something, but also interact with it.
Yeah, I think that kind of providing a media that's relative to a particular date or a particular era is just kind of the tip of the iceberg. Really, the question would be to think in terms of more than just the way we usually interact with computers, which is we look at things, they can present visual images or video, we listen to things, they can present sounds, and we move a mouse or click a button. And the question is, what kinds of motions or data can we actually be feeding into the computer, and what kinds of outputs can it be providing that are kind of more tangible or peripheral or something that's not just on the screen?
We should say, as you could tell, that Bill is just getting over a cold or something, and so
and we've had him here all day
yapping,
talking to people,
right,
so. and
grilling him
on all the great work he's doing. So
you know, I think one of the things we actually just came out of a brown bag lunch where Bill showed off some of these appliances, both envisioned and some of the technologies that you use, like little microprocessors and servos and feedback mechanisms like GPS and so forth to situate people in a physical environment and feedback into some kind of visualization or catalog. So that you can pull up different files and so forth to, for instance, in the case of that great dialing back in time and seeing different images. One of the things that we talked about was, and we haven't talked much about this on the podcast, but, you know, there's a vogue right now, which I assume will go away in the next year or two for Second Life. And I think what's really interesting here that we talked about over lunch was, sort of the differences here between that kind of immersion with an avatar and a completely virtual software environment and the kinds of things you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a great example. Like, I think the thing about something like Second Life is that you have the flexibility to kind of create almost anything, but your interactions with that virtual world are somewhat limited to the kinds of interface technologies that we normally use. I mean, one of the things we talked about in the session today was using things like PlayStation controllers or like the new Nintendo Wii remote, things that use that have the ability to sense more than just kind of key presses, and so that can actually sense motion and space and so forth. And I think Tom came up with a really good example. He says, imagine you can have a virtual 17th or 18th century laboratory set up, but that you could control it with one of these devices so that you could, you know, because it was hard to get things to work out in that environment, and you could send some of that back to the user. So really ways of mixing reality, mixed virtual and actual.
Right. I mean, one of the things that we talk about as historians is how difficult it is to, you know, the past is so different, and, you know, texts help us get there a little bit of the ways there. Images, more recently in history, people have been using sound like music to try to understand and to convey to students what the past was like. But one of the things that I think History Appliances brings about is experiencing a little bit more in a physical way what the past is like. And the way that people, in Tom's case, and maybe Tom, you can explain your example a little bit more, is to actually try to proceed through the way that people did things physically so that you would understand as Tom, you were saying, sort of how difficult, say, science was during the Enlightenment. Tom, do you want to mention the example that you brought up?
Yeah, sure. One of the recent trends in history of science has been the trend towards experimental reconstruction. And what can we learn by recreating historic crucial experiments in the history of science using period instrumentation? And what can we learn about the kinds of tacit knowledge that was required to carry out those experiments? What can we learn about the kinds of social arrangements and the numbers of people that were required to actually make these things work, about the kind of expertise that was involved in doing those kinds of experiments? And you can actually learn something by recreating those experiments that you don't get just by reading about them. or by looking at contemporary images of them. And one of the things I've been thinking about is taking something like the Wii remote controller, which allows the game player to control the action on the screen using a handheld remote. Using something like that to set up virtual historical experimental reconstructions of iconic experiments like Boyle's air pump experiments, and having students in, let's say, physics classes use this technology to kind of get a better sense of what it was like to actually do science, to practice science, rather than in the 17th and 18th centuries, rather than just learning about the theories that came out of 17th and 18th century science, which is really what they're really learning. I mean, the science students aren't learning cutting edge science; they're learning 17th, 18th, 19th century science. In some cases, 20th century science. But certainly, you know, in high school, they're not learning 21st century science. But they're only learning the kind of the distilled theoretical product of science. They're not actually learning the practice of that science. And how can we use these physical technologies, these physical interfaces, to give them a better, to historicize that the knowledge that they're learning, and to give them a better grounding in how that knowledge was created.
I think a lot of people don't work in the history of science don't realize that much of science is, well, scientists know this, but a lot of first year students might not know this, is that there's so much sort of knowledge in the hands in science that went on. Certainly, you know, before string theory, let's say, where it became all mathematics, you might read of the Newtonian laws, but a lot of the experiments that went on really had to do with setting up objects, and the way in which you set them up really changed the outcome of the experiment. And there was sort of technical knowledge and lab knowledge that was passed along from generation to generation. And it certainly, in addition to in the history of science, speaking of trends, there's this trend now to bring in, you know, who were those people in the labs? What were they actually doing? As opposed to just, admittedly, this is more of what I do of the actual theory and mathematical theory that went along with that experimentation. Well, you were going to say something.
Well, I was just thinking, like, in the case that Tom brought up. So, for example, some of these things you definitely want to do in the virtual world, especially the ones that are too poisonous or too potentially dangerous for your students to explore, but giving students access to physical controllers that aren't just a keypad or a mouse, to allow them to actually manipulate things and find out what the consequences of particular kind of embodied knowledge are. Mm-hmm. So, for example, these game controllers let you do things. You can shake something like the Wii and convey information about the velocity, the way that you're shaking it, and so forth. If you know what the result would be, if that's, you know, some chemicals in a test tube or something like that, maybe you have to shake them just to get the thing to come out just right. We can kind of start to teach or start to explore some of the embodied knowledge people have. And we'll be building on skills that they're already getting, say, playing computer games or something like that.
Bill, I know one of the things you've been really interested in is place-based computing. How do you see these historical appliances connecting to that area of your interest?
Okay, so that's a great example. In the in some of the earlier work that I did, I've had either a tablet computer or a handheld computer with a GPS. And as you're standing in a particular place, it will show you, say, you're standing in front of a building. You can see a picture of how that building used to look, or the census records of who used to live there. GPS gives you location. But one of the really interesting things about the kinds of technologies we're talking about is that it becomes possible to have as an input, say, an electronic compass. So you not only know where you are, but which way you're facing. Or you could tilt the tablet or the handheld, excuse me, and an accelerometer inside the device could tell you, it could give you information about that. So you could literally move this device around in front of you, and it would know which way it was facing and which way it was tilted, and give you a view into the past of that environment. For example, that's the kind of additional mm-hmm. beyond GPS functionality that some of these other input and output devices could give you.
we've, you know, at the Center for History and New Media, we've sort of been speculating about doing something like this. The device that we've often thought about is the cell phone. And in fact, we have, a grant in right now to do some historical information delivered to cell phones or a just-in-time delivery of information based on history markers, right? Tom, yeah.
Yeah. We have this idea that we want to deliver the content of these, all the state of Virginia historical markers that are scattered around the roads of Virginia, to deliver the content of those markers to people's cell phones while they're in their cars. If they're too busy to stop or if there isn't a convenient pull-off, they can receive the text of those markers while they're in their cars by their cell phone. But they can also, we can also improve upon that marker content, which is usually only about 150 words. We can improve upon that content with contextual resources, primary source resources, directions to related markers, directions to nearby markers. We can kind of weave together a narrative and create some connections between historic sites and between historic sites and documents using this technology that people already have in their pocket. And one of the things I think I'm most interested in with the cell phone, and I think we're all interested in, is people are carrying around this piece of technology. Everybody's got one. Everybody's got one sitting in their pocket. And they're using it to make phone calls. Maybe they're using it to send text messages. Maybe they're using it to play music. But they're not using it to do anything educational, scholarly, any of the things that we're interested in. And so how can we get our work, the work of digital humanists, onto that platform, that other platform? Because as Bill says, so often we're dealing with this one platform, which is the one that sits on our desk. We're not dealing with these other platforms that may already exist in people's pockets, that may exist in their living rooms, or that we could actually build. And I think that's where Bill is doing some very interesting thinking, is maybe digital humanists shouldn't just be thinking about the interfaces that people already own. Maybe digital humanists should be thinking about building new interfaces for digital humanities work.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Tom. A lot of the, to my mind, a lot of the really interesting stuff that's going on is happening in art. It's happening in electronic music and places like that, where people start off with the idea not only that they want to communicate something expressive or interpretive, but also that the way that they communicate that should possibly be novel or interesting or accessible in spaces that aren't the kind of spaces where historians typically reach audiences. So we expect to reach people reading books, traditional books. We maybe expect, if we're in public history, to reach people in museums or heritage parks or places like that. But I think artists are really thinking there's all kinds of spaces to reach people. And so not just the cell phones that they carry around, but the places where they're waiting in line for coffee, or they're sitting in their car, or they're driving past something. Like, how do we start to create interactions in those spaces that possibly aren't distracting, but might provide more meaning for people?
Well, this is certainly something that we're following, and we're looking forward to seeing some of your contraptions as they get built, and maybe even trying a little bit of this ourselves. I don't know, Bill, if you noticed, but we're right across the hall from the Autonomous Robots Laboratory. So we'll steal some servos from them right after the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
As regular listeners to the program know, we like to end each podcast with our picks of the week. These are links, resources, software, and other things that we found around the web and off the web that we think might be useful for our audience. Tom, maybe we'll start with you this week. What have you found?
Sure. I actually ran into a problem this weekend. When I got my new computer, I didn't install Photoshop CS2 on it because I've been waiting for the Photoshop CS3. And I ended up having to do some image work, and I didn't have anything on my machine to do it with. And so I searched around the web for something free that I could use. All I needed to do was do a little bit of resizing images and things. I found something for the Mac called Seashore. It's at seashore.sourceforge.net. And, you know, it's not anywhere near as powerful as Photoshop, But for, I think probably for like 90% of the things that 90% of the digital humanists out there want to do, it's good enough. And the price is right. It's free. It's free and open source. And I, you know, I really encourage people to take a look at it. It's a Mac only product, but I also probably should mention, just this is sort of more of a tip than a pick. In general, you know, Photoshop is something that the new Photoshop CS3 I was just looking on Amazon costs about $650, you know, and it's a great product, but you can also get what's called Photoshop Elements. I think a lot of people don't know that Photoshop Elements is out there, and that's only about $75. And again, that product does probably, you know, 99% of what 99% of digital humanists really need to do. Now, if you're a designer or a graphic designer or print designer, you're going to want Photoshop or Illustrator, one of the more heavy duty products. But C-Shore or Photoshop Elements is great in a pinch, and I really recommend both.
That's a great recommendation. I just add to that that they're actually now web-based photo editors and image editors that run right in your browser. They're free, and you can access them from everywhere. The one I've used before, which works great, is called Fixr, PHIXR.com. And so that's a bonus link. That's not my link for this week, but I'll just throw it out there as a very handy application.
Yeah, that's a great one.
You're in a pinch and you just want to, you know, convert a color image to black and white or rotate something or add in some text on top of an image. It works great. Export it right to your hard drive and you're done. Mills, what do you have this week?
Well, actually, since Bill Turkle is our guest this week, I have a Bill Turkle site to recommend, and that's a video podcast that Bill put up about place-based computing and the work he's doing at the University of Western Ontario. So if you were interested in the idea of place-based computing using handheld devices and GPS and that sort of thing, that's a great place to go and get a succinct overview of what place-based computing is and how it can work in a teaching environment. That's at digitalhistory.uwo.ca/pbc, place-based computing.
Great. And we'll put up all these links on our show notes, as usual. The link I have for this week is actually, I'm starting to do some looking around for a class I'm teaching, a graduate class in digital history in the fall. And I've been thinking about, well, how to handle introducing students to some of the things I do, some of the things we all do, some of the things that Bill does extremely well, and Bill knows programming and all these other things, and that humanists don't normally know. And so, and I really caught my eye a new program. It's actually a sort of a software development tool called Scratch from MIT. It's available at scratch.mit.edu. And yes, they have a little cartoon cat, I guess named Scratch, as their mascot. And this is a sort of a visual programming environment that's, I don't know if any of you start out with Logo or any of these early programming languages that you could use and were very simple. I mean, even more simple than something like BASIC. And this is unbelievable. It's put out by a group at the MIT Media Lab. And basically, you just take little blocks or little colored blocks and they snap together. So when you want to learn about programming loops or algorithms or making the, you know, listening for a mouse event, like the user pushing down on a mouse, there are little blocks, they're colored, they fit together into little pieces. And so you make a program out of these little colored blocks, and then it runs in a separate window, and you can export it as a Scratch application. It's a really great way to start to learn about programming in a very simple way. I haven't seen an environment like this in a really long time. And so I think it's something I'm going to try to use in my class. Again, that's at scratch.mit.edu. Well, thanks for joining us once again. We'll be back in 2 weeks for another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.